Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
I'm Chet Haas from the UI Toolkit team. And
I am Patrick Bauman from the Android Instant Apps team.
That is a really good coincidence because I wanted to talk about Instant Apps today. So fortunately, we have someone in the room that knows far more about it than I do, which is very little indeed. Okay, so context is a year and a half ago at Google I.O. 2016, we said, here's this idea called Instant Apps. It's going to be really amazing. And then Ficus pushed a button.
Yes.
And now what? And then everything went dark for a while because it turns out it's a hard problem.
Yes.
We called it instant. And the
process of getting there was an instant. So we kind of rebooted after I.O. 2016. We had what amounted to a very complex prototype at I.O. 2016. We had kind of proved it out and started down the path of where we ended up for the eventual rollout and re-announcement, I guess, at I.O. 2017.
Okay, so I'm curious. I mean, it's sort of a typical engineering thing of like, well, here's a prototype. You know, we obviously the rest is just implementation details, and it turns out that's most of the work is making it real. But what was the reboot? What didn't work about the prototype?
So the way that we went about it first wasn't as secure as we would have liked. So without going into too much detail about how that worked, I'll explain where we ended up. One of our main goals from the beginning was to be backwards compatible as far back as we could go. We originally said J, but times have changed, and we are now going back as far as the Lollipop. We're using something that was actually introduced in, I think, Lollipop or maybe KitKat, but the isolated process model that Chrome uses to isolate the web code that it's running. We use an isolated process because it doesn't have file access, doesn't get any of the permissions that a normal app would get, and it gives us an opportunity to intercept binder transactions to services, to platform services or system services.
So that means that, so an instant app doesn't have app permission. So can an instant app use the camera or location?
It can, but that's because of all the work that we did that took so long to finally launch.
I see.
So we intercept, if you ran an app in an isolated process by itself, nothing would happen. It would probably crash. But what we built in all that time, we call it the supervisor, is a system that intercepts the calls that would otherwise go to permission protected things and proxy them through to a process that actually has those permissions and has read-write access. And we translate it on the way so that the app thinks it's in its own, it's running as a full app on the device, but we block things that it shouldn't do. So we don't let it read the external file system, SD card, et cetera. We do our own permissions enforcement. So we make sure that if one of the apps coming from an isolated process requests the camera, that they've declared it in their manifest and requested it in the M permissions model.
And then you go ahead and forward that to the user, presumably, so they still have to give runtime permissions the same as they would with a full-on app.
Yeah, and the nice thing about that is we've been able to implement runtime permissions back to L before it was introduced in M.
Let's get back a little bit more to Instant App. What makes an Instant App instant as opposed to a regular app?
The restrictions that it needs to deal with. So we put certain limits on developers to try to keep these apps running quickly and able to be cleaned up off the device quickly. One of them is that the amount of data that will allow you to download on URL click, which is the kind of indexing into Instant Apps, is 4 megabytes. And most large and popular apps go well beyond 4 megabytes. So as a developer, you have to think about what it is you want in your instant experience, what's most important to your users, and then build
around
that.
So you said cleaned up quickly. So their installation experience is different with these things?
Yes. So you don't need to go through the Play Store to get to them. You click a link in a chat or email or whatever else you might get a link from.
And what does that link look like?
Just a typical
it's
URL.
It's underlined and it's blue.
Usually, okay. Yes.
So for
any HTTP, HTTPS.
Okay, so it could be, for example, if someone wanted to embed, let's say, a Twitter message, it would be like a Twitter URL that I would click on, potentially, if there was some sort of installation for that.
Yes.
And then that could open up a smaller portion of the Twitter app, showing me just that tweet and letting me like it, for example. Is that?
Yeah,
okay.
In theory. Tons of use cases to think about.
So these aren't reserved URLs pointing to the Play Store. These are any
Correct.
URL.
Yeah. I like the way you said that. Like, I don't find your use case very interesting, but there are other ones out there that you could take as
a that could very well be a good one for my mom, who doesn't have Twitter, but maybe she wants to read a tweet in a, you know, native experience, as if she knew what that meant.
And then how prevalent is it? So you click on the link, it magically secretly installs this thing in the background so it can give you the native experience. And then when you back out of that thing, is that going to be cleaned up?
At some point, yeah. So there's a garbage collection process. We make sure that we're not occupying too much space on your device. But in essence, if you never launch it again, it will never run again.
But you keep it around in case this is something that the user does every day. And so
exactly,
it's good cache. Okay.
Yep.
So we'll get more into the architecture later, I hope. But there are different pieces that are going to come down. There's like some core part that the overall application needs, and then there are peripheral parts for, you know, this particular experience. Let's say that native tweet experience that Tora was talking about. So if they clicked on that link and they get, let's say, two chunks down, core plus tweet, then later on, they click on a different link, which is a different tweet or a different part of that application.
Right.
Is it going to retain the core part, even though it may download a different module?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So as a developer, you have the tools at your disposal to build, modularize your app. You have one base and then as many features, we call them, that can sit on top of it as you want. And we will download them as needed without replacing. We won't re-download anything we don't already have.
Okay. And so, then does it reset the timer on the portions that you have reused?
Yep.
Okay.
So a bit more on the justification side. So these things are installing faster and they're easier to discover, I guess. Are there any other sort of business reasons why developers should go to the trouble of making an instant app?
Yeah. I mean, the big one is we're essentially removing install friction.
Okay.
You can get the native experience that you've polished and worked on in front of your users without having to convince them with a big banner or whatever to go to the Play Store, download it, install it, and then wait around that entire time to go and then relaunch it once it's available to you. So,
okay. I've seen when I'm browsing some websites from Chrome on mobile that they'll redirect to some page saying, hey, we have an app, please use this instead.
Mm-hmm.
Could that be improved with this, or is it still the same thing?
Well, ideally, they'll never see that.
Okay.
If they
would just have a link that goes to the story, and that story link would, for example, then just open up their sub instant app that instead does the native.
Well, it still seems like there's a use case. I guess it depends on how the system works, but some of those links, some of those developers may want you to have the entire application, may want you to have it installed on your system so that you go back and, you know, now a HimDB becomes a part of your life instead of just, you know, going and checking this one quick link.
Yep.
So it seems like they would still, in many cases, want you to install the full app as opposed to click on this link, get this experience, and then 2 weeks later, it's not on your phone anymore and we have to convince you to do it again.
I don't know anyone who likes those redirects. Honestly, the, hey, you should install the, like, if you're just trying to read some random article in some newspaper that you don't generally read,
right,
to then neutrally push, hey, install my app.
Right.
Not usually that friendly.
Although I would assume from the developer's perspective, like, they want your eyeballs on their app, not just on that particular piece of content, right?
Possibly. Yeah.
So
I'm
just
saying it's a developer-centric view, not a user-centric view.
Does anybody else matter?
So in my perfect world, which we hope to get to at some point, an instant app will be indistinguishable from a full app. You'll be able to build whatever you want in your instant app. Maybe there will be tons of modules to make that happen. Maybe policies will change, I don't know, but ideally they would be the same thing and your full app would just be committing those and not garbage collecting them in the future. That would be great. But in the meantime, we have APIs that we offer to developers to upgrade to their full app.
Okay.
So you can launch the instant app and then they can, if they want, if there's functionality they can't offer in their instant app yet or they don't choose to offer, they can pop up a little dialogue that says, do you want to install the full version?
We see you've been using this part of our application. You may also enjoy this other part.
Essentially, yes.
Okay. Can you then migrate settings? Or I guess instant apps is a really good way to encourage developers to put their settings in the cloud. Because I'm thinking if I'm using this app and then it accidentally gets garbage collected, and then I come back and I'm suddenly, it's losing my preferences again, that's not great. Right. Is there a way, is there an API to sort of, or I guess, it, is it just a standard cloud backup APIs you use to store information about what the user's doing?
So you as a developer can do use any existing tools you want, but we offer a couple that keep the data local, even across garbage collections. So there was a new API introduced called Ephemeral Cookie in Package Manager. So in Package Manager, you can say, get the ephemeral cookie size and then set an ephemeral cookie. And it's just an array of bytes. So you can use it to store settings, like a small number of settings. You can use it to store like an authentication token or...
And that's persistent forever?
And that will be persisted until the device is low on storage space. I think it's one of the last things to be cleaned up.
Okay. Ephemeral cookie sounds like a horrible lie. Like, here's a cookie. No, it's not.
The naming is, it may have actually been renamed. We went through essentially a rebranding from ephemeral apps to instant apps in the lead up to launch.
Right.
And so there may be some APIs that didn't get renamed. I may be just misremembering.
Okay. So you could think of this as the instant app cookie then.
Essentially,
so it's less about it being ephemeral and more about it being intended for instant app storage.
I picture a PM going through a thesaurus going, you know, ephemeral is a really long word. Do we have something else that we could use instead?
That amounts to, so we have that. That works on O+. And then Prio, we've written backwards compatible versions of it into some of our GMS Core APIs, Google Play Services APIs. So you have that at your disposal in both cases. On O, a upgrade to the full app is actually just a, for the most part, it's a bit we flip in Package Manager. We say this, before we say treat this app as an instant app, keep it in a tighter security sandbox, limit its access to things on the device. When we upgrade it, we just flip a bit and say, okay, now it's the full app.
Okay.
In most cases, that also involves installing an update to it, but what that amounts to is that all of the data that you stored as an instant app is still available to you as the full app.
So then it brings down the rest of the modules and packages it up differently on the system so that now it gets launched as a native app instead of this more sandboxed thing.
Yep.
So can you help me understand the security model? Like, I'm trying to understand why we need to jump through so many hoops to run this in a separate process.
Right.
Like, well, apps are always running in a separate process. We don't need to protect them more. Like,
right. It's basically the friction that we removed. So with a full app, you get a bunch of, depending on what SDK version they're targeting, you may get a bunch of permissions at install time. You get to see the reviews for the app. You see all of the context for the app as part of your clicking of the install button. But with instant apps, you're tapping a button that you may not realize launches an instant app.
Yeah.
You get a loading UI, and then you get that app on your device. So as a result, we've tightened up the sandbox. We don't let the instant app know anything about the device that it's on. We hide a bunch of the device identifiers. We prevent access to long-term storage, external storage.
Okay.
Yeah.
But there's a proxy mechanism where it can get to a bunch of this stuff anyway. So how does that work to further protect
the device? That's with user consensus, right? I assume that's the distinguishing thing here, is that a lot of apps don't have to ask if they've been installed for certain things that aren't dangerous, whereas here they could not be dangerous, but they could leak certain things that you want to lock down.
Correct. And to be clear, we have two different runtimes. We have the platform supported one in O. Those apps are absolutely sandboxed by the system. And on Prio, we enforce that those restrictions with our supervisor app. So all instant apps actually run within the supervisor app, just in isolated processes that don't have, we limit the access to the things that they would otherwise have.
Okay.
Do you have any public stats on how the friction helps with installs? You know, how for people who have gone to this trouble to update their app, instant apps, how successful is this? How frequently do users launch this compared to installing the app?
I am a lowly engineer and don't have those answers.
Okay.
But we do have public docs. A lot of the EAPs that we worked with before launch, we talked
early
to after the fact.
Early access partners.
Yes, early access partners. We use that so frequently that forget. So we did several users or developer studies with some of our early access partners, found out what worked for them, what didn't, modified our plan a little bit, but we've published some of those at the Android Instant Apps docs.
Okay. All right. So the reason why developers want to do this is to help adoption.
Mm-hmm.
And then what specifically do they need to do to take their app? I assume you don't have to start from scratch writing a brand new app, right? So you have an existing app and you want to make it instant. What do they do?
So it depends on what state your app is in. If you have an app that's already below that 4 megabyte limit.
Let's say it's beautifully written spaghetti code.
Then you have a bit of work ahead of you. So unfortunately, because of that 4 megabyte limit, you're going to have to, if you're over 4 megabytes, you're going to have to find ways to split your app up.
That's 4 megabytes of code or 4 megabytes of everything, like resources and, okay.
Your right. APK size. And
so, you know, launcher icon alone is 4 megabytes probably.
I would hope not. You can optimize those things.
Okay. Right.
So there are tools available to optimize your resources. One thing I'll say to watch out for is native libraries tend to contribute a ton to APK size, usually because they bundle all of the different architectures you could target into one APK.
Right. So let's say, simplest case, I have an application that's just 2 megabytes.
Yep.
What would I need to do to make that an instant app?
Simplest case, assuming you build with Gradle, you would take your app module. Let's assume that all your code and resources are in the app module. You would turn that into a feature module. It's essentially a library module. But you would turn that into a feature module, and then you would add 2 new Gradle modules that depend on it. One is an instant app module, and one is an application module. And what that would result in is 2 different targets you could build, one that's your full APK and one that is your instant APK.
And then you upload to the Play Store these 2 artifacts?
Yep. There's a tab on the Play Console for instant apps that lets you upload your instant apps, and there's a alpha, beta, and prod channels, so you can
So there's no actual APIs. It's just a sort of a build time process that you go through to create the artifact.
There are some APIs, things that instant apps shouldn't be able to do. We have an addition to the compatibility library that you can use to help you figure out whether you're in an instant app and should request permissions pre-L, for instance. But generally, yeah, it's usually a practice of restructuring your app, restructuring your build.
Okay. All right. So now the more interesting case, maybe you're
a spaghetti
code. Yeah.
So let's say
case.
My app is 3.9 megabytes. So it technically fits, but it's slow because I have 15 activities in there and I want to make it even faster.
Yep.
So then
let's be clear. You want to make the startup time faster.
Yes, exactly. Right. I've noticed that. Sure. There's, you know, for people with slow connections, it's still a 5 second wait. They just cancel out, realizing, oh no, I don't want that. So I'm trying to make it really instant.
Right.
What do I do then?
So there you would look at your use cases and see how you might be able to modularize your app. Find opportunities to only load what's necessary to get the user to the activity that they're launching.
So I could make 5 or 6 different instant apps out of my APK. I could have one that goes straight to, you know, let's take the Twitter example again. I could have one that shows a tweet. I could have one that is like a compose a tweet.
Yep.
Right. And so each one of these are activities. And so I would make a separate instant app module for each then.
Yeah. And
I would try to get as little code as possible into each module. So I would try to modularize it so that only this activity plus what it needs is okay.
Correct. Yes. And so you'll, the tools you're limited to are you absolutely need a base module. So that's a feature module that has a special tag in it that says I'm the base.
And these are the common utilities that all the activities would depend on?
Yeah. You can, I think technically you can duplicate code if that makes sense to you. But generally, yeah, you'd want to pull all your common resources. Yeah. You absolutely need your app title, icon, anything that would be displayed somewhere in the system needs to be in your base.
Okay.
But if you put stuff in there that isn't needed by all the instant apps, then you're making the instant app necessarily slower, right? So you really want to modularize into more of these libraries. So the base should ideally be as small as possible, and then you could have additional intermediate ones that...
So intermediate isn't supported yet. But we hope to get there.
Okay, so it's a hierarchy of two. It's base plus mine. Okay, I see. Yeah.
Well, so there's, I mean, it depends on how many other activities could benefit from that shared resource, because it does seem like you would be saving in the long run if you could put more of the shared functionality, even if it wasn't shared by everybody, into the base, because once that comes down, then all of the other activities
could be lighter.
If people
use multiple of them,
Right. I feel like the retail use case is a pretty good example of how you can split up your app. So say you have you have a retail app. With the retail app, you would have like a details page or like your browse page. It's likely that your users are going to come in from search there, so that's likely your biggest entry point into your app. That you might want to bundle into your base module. That way, your base comes down, they don't need anything else, and they can browse through what you have in inventory. Then at some point, they're probably going to want to check out, so you may want a cart module that would bring down resources for displaying your cart. And then, say they got so far, they may want to actually check out and pay. You would bring down a payment module that brings them through your payment flow, likely brings down payment processing library and anything unique to payment processing that you would need to.
And again, the reason we go to this trouble is that if we put too much stuff in there, then it gets slower and people might bail, and you don't want that.
Right.
Because then they're not going to make that purchase.
Yep.
Okay.
Exactly.
So I'm curious. So one of the big drivers clearly is size, and the reason you have this sort of arbitrary 4 meg limit is just to make sure that it can be, I'll do air quotes, instant.
Yes.
Fairly fast on a reasonable connection.
Yep.
There is that weird dynamic in some, other locales where maybe data costs a lot, or people don't have dependable data, where even 4 megabytes might be a lot, especially if they have to do it multiple times for the same experience. So like, where is that trade-off for different markets where, even though it was a faster experience, the fact that you have to do it multiple times every time you click on that link, if you don't do it every day, then you keep re-downloading the same bits.
Right. So the good news is this is all stuff that we can manage differently going forward. I will say one thing for managing markets, being that we have, for Instant Apps, we generally have a fallback, the web. Most of our developers thus far have a web presence. They want to get their native experience out front. But in a market where the connections are poor, we can fall back to the web and everything is at least as it was before Instant Apps. Mm. And so if we detect that we're on a really bad network, a lot of times we may say, hold off, let's dispatch to the web for now and wait till they're on a better network.
Wait, this is something that like developers would do?
This is something that Play would do to manage the user experience.
Okay, walk me through that, because I'm not seeing how it would do that. So someone clicks on a link that theoretically would download the Instant App, and then what
we
happens?
Can check network conditions. We can use we can check to see whether you're on a 3G or 2G network.
When you're saying this is the part of the code when you click a link, you decide whether or not is there an Instant App handler for this. You can say, actually, because of the network, we can say there isn't one, even though we know there is one. And then the link will just be handled by the normal Chrome interceptor or whatever.
Yep.
Okay.
But then the developer must need to do something on their website to make sure that, okay, well, we just got a redirect for the Instant App failed flow.
I didn't follow the engineering behind that too much, but I think we were working on a way to, forward through to the mobile web that Instant Apps are normally supported on this device. But
my impression is just that, for the Twitter example again, there already is a URL that takes you to an individual tweet.
Yeah.
Right? You would use that exact same URL in Instant Apps. So you would register an intent filter saying, I recognize that exact pattern and I can provide an app for that. If there isn't an app for that, then of course it'll just go to the web with the normal URL that actually loads the tweet. So if you make your URL handler handle the exact same URLs as the web would, then you have the fallback.
Okay. So is Twitter a sponsor of this episode?
I don't know why it was on my mind today.
Twitter is not, at least as far as I'm aware. So there's that. And then there's also, we also, while we have a 4 megabyte limit, we want it to be as small as possible, as instant as possible. The closer to 4 megabytes, the longer the delay, especially the worse the connection.
Is New York Times an instant app?
New York Times has a crossword instant app.
Okay. They should, because I have their app and I'm a subscriber, but whenever I'm clicking on a story, I would like that to be an instant app so that I get the app experience, which has better scrolling, right, than a web.
Are we looking for More sponsors?
Yeah.
Is that what's going on here?
Well, it just seems like another perfect example, right? You can have a URL pointing to an article. And that seems like you know, you may not want to go and install the app just because you wanted to read the story. But as a, if you were just, you know, seeing this URL in any other place, you might want to get that app, which could then also do more things to sort of show you additional things.
It's tricky though, because like I've noticed things like Times and Washington Post, like they're also trying to figure out the payment model, right? Like they'll, I can see an occasional article and then I've read a few and now they really want me to pay a monthly subscription.
Perfect example for
fee,
the ephemeral cookie, right?
I guess so they can sort of ref count the articles. But like at some point that you know, click on the link and get the native experience doesn't work for them because they're not making money off you for, you know, if you keep clicking through these rich app experiences.
So we have an answer for that.
Okay.
Or we may have answers depending on use cases. But we have been pushing developers, if they do authentication and they want to keep track of a user and not have to ask the user to log in every time they launch their Instant App after garbage collection, we encourage them to look into Google Smart Lock, which is a Google-managed authentication and password manager. The experience of that is if you've logged into that app manually before and said, yes, Smart Lock, I would like to save this password, or the app uses APIs to store their token into Smart Lock, the next time that they launch on any device that they're logged into with that Google account, that app will automatically log in for them.
It's magic. So I have this experience with Netflix. I think they must use it. So now whenever I set up Netflix on a new device or anything like that, suddenly just Smart Lock has logged me in.
Yeah, and you don't
need
to use...
Please, developers, please use it. It's so great as a user.
And it's not necessarily Google authentication. It's whatever authentication mechanism you want to use. Netflix is an example. Whatever your credentials are with Netflix, they'll use and log you in. So that's one way that you can at least keep track of the user that is launching the app, assuming that they've logged in at some point. And then the other side of the problem is payments. If you sell digital things, you can use in-app billing that Google Play offers. And then there's also the Google Payments API, which I'm not as familiar with, but it lets you do payment processing outside of just, say, Google Wallet and the Google offerings that we have.
Actually, it would be kind of nice. I mean, if I wasn't a subscriber and I read this article and I'm getting 80% of it or 50 or whatever, and it's pretty good, and it could say, you know, micropayment, you know, 25 cents to read the rest of this. That would be kind of nice, actually. Yeah.
All right, then.
There you go.
I'm trying to figure out, like, we talked about, what didn't we talk about?
Well, I kept trying to come back to the sort of the business justification and then what developers have to do. We haven't talked much about how it actually works. Well, we talked about the process isolation, I guess.
Right.
There's the tooling experience. I don't know if we covered all aspects of that. We got partway down there where, okay, so you break it up, which I kind of like anyway, because it does seem like it is a way to enforce an architecture or an application where architecture can be useful anyway.
Right.
Like if you just start hacking up an app and you're working on the prototype and then you just like pile more code onto it, then eventually you have that spaghetti code and it's all this single mess. And then it's harder to add more functionality to it because like where the hell do you put the stuff? So it's nice to have an architecture. You don't force yourself to do that, but this could be a forcing function that's good.
Yeah, we actually had a lot of developers during I/O 2016 and more so 2017 come up to us and say, like, this is going to be painful, but we've been wanting to do something like this for a while. Like, it gives you an opportunity to, it like you said, it's a forcing function to think about how you want to structure your app. And it has the added benefit that with the improvements that we've had in Gradle, more dependent modules will lead to faster builds, will lead to...
Okay, so take me through that at the risk of losing me because you're talking about Gradle again. But like, why is Gradle a helper there?
I think with 3.0 or one of the Android Studio releases and
it's
build plugin. What's that?
Yeah, 3.0.
3.0 had some pretty massive improvements in I guess caching and optimization of modules.
Yeah. As of 3.0, you can indicate when you depend on something whether you are depending on it transitively. So should you expose your dependencies to your children or is it an implementation detail? And that means that if you're just saying, hey, this is an implementation for me, anyone depending on you do not have to be recompiled when that upstream dependency changes. So they can do a lot more compiler avoidance, you know, compilation avoidance.
Didn't they solve that with make about 50 years ago? Is this, like, am I missing something here? Like, this is normal dependency chain analysis, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
It's
all right.
True.
All right, that's fine.
But I mean, yes.
It's complicated. Software is complicated.
Well, but I think even make can't really help you with this, right? So if you have a rule that depends on another rule, that depends on another rule.
Yeah.
It doesn't know that if you change that innermost one, that you can actually skip doing the leaf one because in the middle there, you've declared that you don't care about those kinds of indirect dependencies.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So this is like a build speed optimization issue that it allows you to do faster builds if you've architected this thing because you can get the dependencies nailed down.
It's a bit, I think the other argument other than what you said, which is, hey, you can now finally justify that refactoring job to your boss because engineers love refactoring, but you can never say, hey, let's refactor everything, right?
Right.
Now, like, oh, we have to because of instant apps and you're going to make more money.
Yep.
When we switched from go-tos to object-oriented programming, that was the same kind of benefit. There actually is a benefit to forcing boundaries between things because you get rid of some mess that you otherwise would have just lived with because the go-to worked just fine.
Yep. You get rid of mess. It forces you to think about cleaning up your APIs a little bit, maybe getting rid of some of the parameters that just snuck their way in because it was quick and easy.
Yeah.
But we did get a lot of feedback saying it looks like it's going to be tough, but we've been wanting to clean up our code for a while, or we've been wanting to refactor or modularize or what have you.
So that was the feedback before. Have you heard from developers afterwards saying it was tough, but it was helpful?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly that. Yeah.
Okay.
We to be fair, we had some in the lead up to 3.0 stable, we had some build tools. Issues that were ironed out, and our Prio runtime had some bugs that were ironed out. The story has been getting better.
We should talk a little bit about the modularization refactoring, too. Are you familiar with it? Do you want to say anything, or do you want me to talk about it?
You could probably speak better than myself, too.
All right. So we've added this modularization refactoring in 3.0. I would call it experimental. It does not solve everything for you, but what it does is it's aware of instant apps, although it's not intended just for instant apps. So you basically say, I want to modularize my code. And you have some current code that you're pointing at as the entry point. So you might start with an activity and say, okay, now modularize this. Yep. So it looks at your selected classes, and then it figures out what is everything you transitively depend on. So it look at all the calls out of your class or types that your class is referencing, and those recursively. And so you can find out what are all the code you'd have to pull in if you wanted to move this into a separate module. And it also does this for resources and manifest registrations. And if it says, fine, I can do this, you just say, okay, go. And then it'll do it. It'll make it, I think it makes a new module, or you can point it to an existing module. It'll move all the code over there, right? So this lets you extract all the code you depend on into a separate module. Now, in practice, you know, most apps that we played with for this tool would have like a utility class, and that utility class would then point out to all these other types. So for example, for the Santa Tracker sample app, if you try to do this from any of the activities, it'll move 95% of your app anyway. So it's just moving all the code. It doesn't really help. So the next thing you have to do is you have to decide, how am I going to cut the spaghetti, right? I see, in the UI for this refactoring, we show you the dependency graph, sort of. It's not a graph, but it shows you as a tree. So you can see, okay, well, activity foo depends on activity bar, depends utility baz. And you can say, actually, that one is pulling in a lot of stuff. I'm going to cut the connection there. So then you can sort of uncheck that item and say, I'm not going to move utility class. And then you proceed. Now you are moving part of the code out, but it's broken, right? Because that one class was referencing a utility class that you didn't move. Now you have to do manual surgery. That surgery can be really painful if your app is truly, you know, a spaghetti monster. But it might, on the other hand, it could just be a few of these bad classes. And you go, okay, I'm going to split you up. I'm going to take these three methods over into the base. I'm going to leave the other one, call it utilities two. Probably not that.
Yeah.
And then you've made this happen. So that's the basic idea with this refactoring. We clearly can do more there to sort of help you work through the flow so you're not in the dialogue doing this. Maybe there could be some sort of assistant instead.
Oh, yeah. But Clippy for instant apps.
There you go.
Yeah.
I don't know if Clippy, you know, we have the new assistant window that we added last year for helping with Firebase. And in 3.1, we're doing more with it, and something that hasn't shipped yet, but it's going to help you with ADB connections. We could have a flow like that, right? Where it sits sort of over on the right-hand side. It's walking you through the flow. It has action buttons for things like, you know, well, in Firebase, you could establish a connection, for example. This thing could help you say, okay, you know, have seven remaining, you know, unmanaged dependencies that you don't want to pull in, and you could click to navigate through and edit your code. So we could do something like that. We haven't done that. We're still exploring what to do in this area.
Yeah, the refactoring tool was one of the things that we said we don't think we could ship a reasonable experience without something in that regard. We pushed pretty hard for that.
Yeah.
And that was like the minimum viable product sort of thing. Like
It certainly has many things that we want to do more with. Yeah. In fact, I think that right now it doesn't support Kotlin, although we're fixing that. Mm-hmm. But we definitely want to do more.
Right.
But it will not be able to do all your work for you. Like you can't, if you have a dependency chain that is, you know, if you have class A and class B both referencing each other, which is totally valid, Java and Kotlin, well, we can't split that. If you're saying, I want to move one but not the other, well, then you have to do something. I mean, we could introduce an extension point and all these things, right? But it gets tricky.
It's useful for identifying where the work you really need to do.
Yeah.
It's useful to help you tear apart the spaghetti code and find out, no, I don't want to bring that payment-specific thing over to my base module, so how do I... switch it from red to black.
Yeah, and with resources, we can do a pretty good job, right? So we figure out what code are you moving, what resources does it reference, and from there we can figure out the reasons you have to move, and those we can move without a problem because you can't have cycles and resources. So that saves a bit of time.
So once you've gone through this, you've cut all the spaghetti cord and you've modularized this thing, you have your feature module. And then all the activity modules, then what? Then you just create the separate artifact saying, okay, instant app 1, instant app 2, instant app 3, and upload them all, and you're done.
The Gradle feature modules that you've created are will build separate instant app APKs.
Yep.
And then the artifact that you actually get out of the build is a zip file that contains all the APKs that are necessary to launch your full instant app. And so you can... we're finessing the build output, and it'll be reworked in the future. But right now, you would unzip that file, and on O, you can ADB install multiple to install them all on the device and make sure it works.
In the IDE, can you just hit the run button?
Or you can also hit the run button.
Okay,
yes. That's the easy way.
It'll
to
run
do
all
it.
The ADB commands you need. Okay.
And then for the interaction with the Play Store, are you uploading like this single zip file with everything, or is there a separate artifact for each one of these
things?
We
upload the single zip file. Okay. We did that to optimize for publishing, basically.
Okay. And then there's some manifest or some login there that tells Play Store these are the different things that should be split out of this for the separate experience.
Yeah, so technically they each APK essentially describes what it
Got
contributes,
it.
And then the base is where the primary manifest is that describes the whole app.
Okay. All right. And then you're done. So everybody should just do that then.
Yep.
Okay.
Super easy.
So I saw a helpful talk on this recently at a GDG DevFest in Nantes by Cyril Mottier, which I will link to from the show notes. That was worth it because he sort of took you through the entire flow through the tools. It sounded like there were some sticky bits about getting there. I can't remember the details on that. So like the system works in general. I don't know if there are things to be aware of that people should, you know, yes, this will be improved or this is still a problem. If you can speak to those.
I don't have them off the top of my head, but we are working through a little bit of rough edges. We've run into a few issues around resources and referencing them between these APKs. But I unfortunately, I don't remember them off the top of my head. And I would encourage anyone who runs into something that doesn't work as they always expect to file a bug because we're paying very close attention.
So where would they file that?
Public
bug tracker for...
It's the new Google bug tracker.
Yeah. But like, what's the category? Is there an instant apps
there
category?
Should be an instant apps category, okay. Yeah.
Issuetracker.google.com?
I believe so, yeah. Okay.
And then are there good examples who could also be perfectly valid sponsors for us to reach out to?
There are a bunch of... I've been seeing actually a bunch of sample apps showing up on GitHub.
Yep.
Google hosts a lot of sample apps for very particular use cases. We're publishing a lot of Firebase examples now.
Okay.
Now, if you're not a developer, but you're just curious about Instant Apps, is there a particular Instant App that you've used that you like? So if someone wants to just experience what it's like to use one.
Yeah, I keep coming across them. One of the better ones I can mention is the New York Times crossword.
Okay.
Just search on Google for New York Times crossword. One of the links will have a little lightning bolt on it to signify it's instant. And you can play the daily crossword from New York Times.
I noticed, I was expecting this to come up already, but it didn't, that nowhere did you say that an important aspect of being instant is to remove the sleep calls from your on-create call. I would assume that that's also good practice for instant apps.
Mm-hmm. But not exclusive.
Maybe the
to
tool could actually do that automatically. That you should be able to do some code inspection
to find sleep calls
Lint.
In activity.
Yeah. Maybe a Lint warning.
Oh. Yeah, you know, you're saying that as a joke, but actually, someone did file a bug that we should do that because someone has been using thread.yield and thread.sleep in their code. So, I think Adam asked me a while back to file a bug against it.
Can we just block developers from Play Store? We could do APK analysis.
I'm sure the commit message was like fix race condition. I'm sure something like that.
there was an engineer years ago in a completely different platform and company and setting and environment who fixed a bug. Well, a test wasn't passing or an app crash or whatever, and they basically commented out code until that test passed, and then they checked in the results with a bunch of commented out code. The other 900 tests now crashed because none of the functionality was there, but at least the one that he was trying to fix worked.
All right.
So that's also an approach. Tools could do so much to save time and energy.
They could.
Stop us from shooting ourselves in the feet.
Yeah. Just remove the feet.
Yep.
So basically, anything that an app can do, an instant app can do, is that true? There's no area of functionality that you're restricted from using.
Correct. And anything an app can do, it goes the other way around. Anything an app can do. But there are restrictions for instant apps.
Okay, and what are those restrictions?
There's a list of them posted online, but some good examples are you can't query for other packages on the device. You can't get access to device identifiers. You can't read or write external storage.
You launch intents. Can you interact with the other apps on the device?
So you can launch generic intents. You can like launch a share intent or I can't think of any other examples off the top of my head. But you also can't do things like post notifications from the background. Like push notifications are not an option at the moment for you. You can't run in the background. So as soon as you're out of the foreground, we essentially kill your process to make sure that you're not doing things the user wouldn't expect.
Yep.
This all seems fair. This seems like things you would want to prevent so that you don't have malicious apps just starting to use it to spy on you.
Yeah, our goal is to make it as close to a full app.
Yeah.
Give you as many tools as a full app would have, but with the limitation being
that it can just run without you feeling bad about it. Yeah.
Actually, the background thing is interesting because the platform is moving in that direction anyway. Like, clearly, we want some stuff to happen in the background. That is important, but we're constraining the amount of things you can do in the background just to save on battery and processing power.
Right.
So it's something that developers should keep in the back of their mind anyway. Yep.
We do allow, along those same lines, we do allow foreground services. So you, as a instant app, can say you play music or you're like an Uber or Lyft style app where you book a ride and then you want to go do something else, will allow you to post a notification to run a service so that the user at least knows that you're still doing something on their device.
Okay. Nice. So.
That seems like for thinking of the ride sharing services, that seems like a really great opportunity too for an instant app where you can instantly hook into payment information, right? Because you want to make the friction for sign up as low as possible. You don't want to force them through a website or an app where they have to go and create an account. Whereas, because an instant app, you could basically have one of those login with and then the various account providers. That should be easy to implement, I would think. And
we had one of our early partners was Jet, which is the Amazon alternative. Essentially, they're a really nice retail app. And they implemented deep linking for their detail pages, so you could search Google for Jet, whatever thing you wanted to find. You'd get a link that when you clicked, it would launch the instant app, and you could go all the way through payment with Jet. You could purchase anything from their store, and They did smart lock, so you were automatically signed in after the first time. They supported the Google Payments API, so you could use whatever you had registered with Google to make your payment, and it was pretty slick.
Oh, that sounds really good.
Yeah.
So did we miss anything?
No. What did we not ask about?
Or what else did you want to talk about?
I think we've covered just about everything. I've been on the project for so long that I have forgotten what I should talk about at this point.
Well, this is what we ask for wise words at the end.
Yes. Well, we could. I mean, it also sounds like it's still being worked on, and there's yes. future stuff yeah. to come. We don't typically talk about future, but clearly we're still working on the system. Hopefully, it works well enough for developers to use right now.
We are trying to address all the developer pain that we some that we predicted, some that we didn't, and so we have things that we're working on to help address size limits, some of the frustrations with tools. So there's a lot in the pipeline. We're a large and very busy team.
All right.
Yeah. Nice. All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having me.